Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Chips of Chorlton. We are basking in the absolutely beautiful Chorlton sun at the moment. It's a very special podcast today. I am joined by three Dutch uncles and one member of Everything Everything.
Hello.
Hello. Introduction, you're last, by the way, because you're the guest. So, to my left,
order of importance.
Robin.
Hello.
And Andy.
Hi.
Duncan.
Indeed.
And Jeremy from Everything Everything.
Actually, this the opening exchanges at this point, I would like to acknowledge how I was downgraded last week from very special guest to special guest.
Just
to
Jeremy Pritchard.
To guest. Which I think was generous in itself, given that there's every likelihood I've just run into you in the pub today. Because we've got the football on. And so anyway, I'll take what I can get. So thanks for having me.
Welcome guest.
And obviously, I was thinking, like, it's getting to that Alan Partridge face. Thank you for not pulling out on the
day.
I got a better idea. Why don't you shove it up your own ass? Right, Jeremy's pulled out.
Sue Cook's pulled out.
So yeah, we've got loads of stuff. I want to talk to you in particular, Jeremy. We discussed earlier in the week. We're not going to absolutely roast the hell out of you, by the way. So
I would be fine with that.
That's great.
It's good.
Famous last words.
Yeah. But we're going to discuss, obviously, America. You've been away to America recently. We're going to discuss probably the big gig at the Ali Pali you did. That's really interesting as well, and all the gigs and all the small venue shenanigans that you're involved with.
Yes.
But I thought we'd do a bit of business before pleasure.
Business before pleasure.
Yeah, we're going to talk about video streaming. Video streaming will now be part of the charts.
Yeah, which is recent news, isn't it?
Yeah.
And not insignificant.
So when streams were first added to the singles chart in 2014, a conversion metric was arrived at where 100 streams would equal one sale. It was then recalibrated at the start of 2017, and then what is announced that 150 streams would be one sale. The latest changes, effective from July the 6th, will see a new metric of 100 premium streams will be one sale versus 600 ad-supported streams. How does that help you in Everything? How does that help you lot in Dutch Uncles?
It doesn't help us.
Jeremy?
I don't know if it helps anybody immediately. I think so much of this is cast it out there and see what happens, isn't it? Yeah. And that's why they're redrawing the battle lines
after
every
18
other month.
Months of redrawing the battle lines.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't realise it was now, or had previously been, 150 to one sale. I actually thought it was equivalent to 1,000 is 9, as in just under 1%. But actually, it's obviously less than that.
So. And video plays as well. I suppose the interesting part of this is that YouTube are now going to have an ad-free subscription on top of your Spotify subscription, and people have Netflix and all the Amazon Prime stuff as well. So to get the ads out of YouTube, you will now have to pay. How much would you pay for it, by the way? Ad-free
this
YouTube.
Is pure speculation because none of us know, so let's go around the table.
What do you think it would be, Rob?
What would you do? How much would you pay for ad-free YouTube music and video?
So I'm not that bothered, to be honest. I can wait 30 seconds for whatever,
for anything.
Yeah,
I will as well.
Peep Show might be rewatching on YouTube. It's not the end of the world to that, but £3 a month.
Okay,
three.
Or is this how much we would pay?
How much would you pay?
Yeah. How much would I pay?
What do you think?
Nothing over a tenner. Probably like I'll go $6.99.
Lovely.
Knowing how many people there are in the world, knowing how many dead-eyed stares I've seen on public transport, and how much we're all looking at our phones, I'd say £1. I think if they could just get adverts out of the way for £1 each, YouTube are already coining it in.
I think if it was that price point. Why do people say that? Then I think they probably would actually get
a lot
people to pay for it. But I personally wouldn't pay anything for it because I just don't have the need, really. Yeah. And when I do, I would be happy to wait 5 seconds or 30 seconds or whatever it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose I'm in the same boat. So it's $11.99 per month.
What?
I was going to say what I thought it was the same as what you said, Andy, which was $6.99. I thought it might be that sort of ballpark, less than Spotify Premium.
And that's just YouTube as well.
So that's YouTube and YouTube Music ad-free.
But there are documentaries on YouTube in particular that people really do want to watch that are like an hour and a half.
It's true.
If you're into that sort of stuff, and yeah, YouTube's a platform for that.
But if it's an hour and a half, can you not stomach the 30-second ad?
Well, the ads must be staggered at that point.
Maybe if it's that long, yeah.
So let's talk about the videos then. So with the video plays now contributing to an album position.
I mean, yeah, we were having a bit of a sort of a preamble about this before, weren't we? About kind of, I think what it does, what this does, is it sets a dangerous precedent for bands to really discover the impact of viral. I think people will be like, right, okay, well, if video players are going to get involved in this, it doesn't necessarily matter like the quality of the video or like the impact of the image of what we're trying to say is our statement within our music. Mm-hmm. But it's more about just getting people to click on it and go, oh, did you see that thing? And it's really wacky. Like OK Go did.
They did that, yeah.
Field Music video for In Context.
Yeah.
Which has had a load of views.
That's had millions of views. Yeah, the Field Music
In
Context
video.
Which
might get unfair because it has... That one in particular has nothing to do with the band. And it'd be interesting to see the amount of people who gave one about the music.
But my initial feeling is I think it's unfair to sort of add that competition for upstart, you know, for upstart bands and for indie bands to be like, right, okay, well, if we want to, you know, because like for us, you know, we narrowly missed out on a top 100 with Big Balloon because of streaming plays.
Depends on website you check.
Yeah. Depends on the metric.
And we stand by that to the death. But this is just another element to throw in with that success. Where
yeah,
it's going to be,
you could suffer from it.
You could suffer from it because other people have done better with that element.
Another level of cynicism.
Yeah.
And of course, for the mega pop stars, Ariana Grande, Katy Perry, whatever, videos are already enormous and aren't counting towards their chart places.
I found myself.
They almost all are already weighting the product towards that outlet.
Mm. Yeah.
And if it's actually going to have a kind of financial kickback, they're just going to do even better out of it, and bands like our own are going to do even worse.
But the matter of videos is an interesting one. I mean, the question I wanted to ask you, Jeremy, about this on this topic was... what's your impression in terms of musicians, bands having to consider visualizing the songs that they're making in the studio? Because you're in quite a unique position where Jonathan in the band,
we're very lucky to have him. Really, for more than one reason.
Very hands-on
for more than this reason, he also sings the songs. but he'll even sometimes as he's writing be thinking about how it might pan out. In this way,
that's
in a visual
way, so useful.
Which is such an asset, you know, and that's a rare thing to have in a band. Having said that, I never watch any videos. I barely watch our own. I'll watch the first two versions and then, you know, we'll edit them and then that's it. I'll never revisit them because I don't really want to have my imagination when I listen to the songs sullied by one person's version of it. Sometimes I enjoy videos, sometimes I don't. I've seen all the Radiohead videos, but I don't go back to them really.
Was there a point where Jonathan didn't do the videos?
Only very recently.
Okay.
Partly because we were touring and we were busy, and also we kind of felt that we'd taken it as far as we can with our own brains.
But you did them all from the beginning.
Pretty much, yeah. And even when we've had other directors come on board, the treatment will be heavily involved in that.
Yeah.
From the outset.
I think it's great from a fan point of view as well for people to.
It is, and that's
to get a very literal interpretation, and there's almost you can get like a full-on feeling for the song, for the lyrics, for the sort of 360 aspects of a song, which is great.
And you can only augment your own identity if you choose to get involved with that stuff.
Budget was another question I was going to ask, because you guys have released your albums on major labels, so obviously there's more budget there for what we would be doing on an indie.
Yeah. By the time we get to a fourth single on an album, we're dealing with much the same money that you are, or our own money, I would say. But the money is there to do the first one, and then to a lesser extent on the second, and then the third, you have to scrap for a couple of grand,
of course. Then
the fourth, you're going to pay for it yourself. If you're
or unless you've got a real passion for it.
So it does kind of project. Yeah, because what you're trying to do at that point is sell an album, and the label are happy to put money into that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's a strange aspect to the culture. I think.
Yeah.
It's not one that I personally am indigenous to at all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of with you. I don't really care for music videos anymore.
No, me neither.
I mean, I used to watch them. I used to come home from school, put MTV on, you know, I mean, MTV yeah. One.
Michael
MTV
Jackson videos I was obsessed with as a yeah. kid. He lived in that era.
Well Moonwalker was such an eye-opener for, you know, any... For me, that was my first big exposure to Michael Jackson, was the Moonwalker film, which was a compilation of all of his videos. Then, obviously, that mad film
sort of
where he turns into a space Lamborghini. I don't know how that
with,
really...
What's his name in it?
Yeah, anyway. So
just to bring the tone down on videos, though, I was going to say, I got home from school once, flicked on MTV2, and saw the video for Boy Kill Boy, Civil Sin, and then rang Robin immediately just to tell him how amazing this song was.
I was like, did you see that? I was like, of course I saw it.
But that was the gold. That was the golden age for indie music videos. Like, as soon as MTV2 changed to MTV Rocks, it's all gone down the shitter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's all become Snow Patrol versus Foo Fighters, and it's like that sounds like one
Twitter
of our
poll.
That sounds like one of our drunk Twitter polls that we do more and more often these days.
Lady Fuzz versus the Stone Roses. Was the last one. It was close.
Standing by that is a close call.
Oh, amazing!
Only two comments below. Both said shite.
So what everyone's been? What have you been up to, Robin? You've had your Pripyat thing recently, haven't you?
Yes, yeah, we had another screening of a Birdsong story from Pripyat at Low 4 earlier this month.
Yeah, looked great.
Yeah, it went really well.
And to counteract that culture, we went on a big massive session on your stag do. Could
the
you don't get
weekend? Yes, it was my stag do. Yeah,
which we are all sort of struggling with at the minute, aren't we?
We got back 3 days ago, and we are all still in slight peril.
Yeah, well, I'm almost there now.
Your best men had an impromptu 7-pint piss up when we got home. So, I mean, that was really uncalled for. Andy. Yeah.
Well done, lads. Just to
don't
make sure.
Don't say Andy.
Yeah. I went home.
Andy.
And you've been to America recently.
Yeah,
Jeremy.
We did a 3-odd week tour in America
with a quick layover.
In Manchester and York, funnily enough, where you just had your stag. We basically reasoned that we needed to take the park life booking to spend the money that we'd make on that and playing York University, which we also did, in America. So that whole period came dangerously close to breaking even as a result.
Wow. Without those two,
it would just be a huge black hole. And actually on paper it is, because no tour manager will budget the two as one tour. It's the US tour,
of course.
And then there's this little weekend in the UK. But as far as we're concerned, it all comes out in the wash. It's all the same period or whatever.
Yeah, so. In regards to this latest excursion in the States, did you guys get funding for that? Did you get like a momentum funding for that
We
tour?
Didn't get momentum funding for that. We did, the first time we went to South by Southwest in 2010, we got PRS... Is that what they called it? The PRS Momentum Fund?
I think it is, isn't it?
Because you've had that as well.
A few people.
PRS Foundation, which is a separate thing to the PRS that pays us every quarter for royalty-wise. It's a separate thing, and it's a good thing. So, we had that once, and I think once you've had that, that's that. We did have a different set of funding from the BPI, the British Phonographic Industry, to go to America, I think last year, or maybe the year before that. As well, so we've done quite well at that. But basically, America, the message here is that America is a financial black hole for British bands, and it is undeniable, and you know that as well.
And yet we have
this cultural fascination.
Yes,
with
we're trying to break it.
Well, and it's a vanity project on the part of British bands. Yes and no, because actually, the infrastructure isn't there in other territories to say, okay, the X thousand pounds we'd spend touring America with limited resources and limited reward, you could spend that in Asia and actually build an audience, build a career. But actually you can't, because the infrastructure isn't there yet.
Yeah.
You could spend it in Europe and it would go a really long way.
Yeah.
But because we've been so cosseted as British bands being on at the gateway to Europe, we're about to lose that privilege, but we are... You know, we've been in its corner for so long that we don't think of it as a priority. We don't think of it as something that's worth spending a huge amount of money on, as we do with America. And I think that's partly because we're still under this sort of the American spell, English. The fascination that the Beatles had in the 50s in Liverpool, with the GIs bringing in Chuck Berry records.
I mean, I was going to say,
we still have that.
Yeah.
It drives such an enthusiasm within the band when it's all laid out like that, that you must find yourselves kind of saying yes to every possible promotional opportunity or any situation like that.
Certainly,
like,
once
like,
we're
do
over
you find
there.
Yourself like do you have like moments where you find yourselves doing like really weird acoustic sets in like, you know, bullshit shops, where you just kind of go like, wow, I thought this was behind us, but it's not behind us because we're here.
You
in
do
the
have
new
to
frontier.
Kind of downgrade your expectations once you're over there.
It's like as...
the touring we did in the UK in 2008-2009 is the kind of touring we still do over there. There's nothing wrong with that, and it's a privilege. It's still a privilege. And I say it's like the touring we did in the UK in 2008, 2009. It's not, because we're not playing to a sea of blank faces. The people that will turn up to those shows, four albums in, are deeply invested. There are no rubberneckers.
With America being like an obvious black hole, do you draw satisfaction when you have reasonable crowds there?
Well, this is the thing, because we've talked
still get disappointed
about...
When there's not as many as you thought would be, or is it
yes
just
and yes? I guess because we've talked about just being brave and saying we're just not going to do it anymore. We're not going to go to America anymore because that would be the most pragmatic thing to do. Yeah. And with the money we make over the festival season, we'll just earn that money and we'll spend it on.
But
we never do. Every time we go back there, there's still enough to keep coming back.
You're quite right to do so, because that's
building a career.
You should have ambition.
And
it is irresistible.
Is that the reason why? If something penny, the penny drops in America, the literal penny drops. Do you know what I mean?
If you get Letterman.
Yeah. Well.
Well, we did a James Corden.
Yeah.
What do they call that? The late show.
The late
we did
show.
That in LA. I don't think it really moved the needle for us. It wasn't perfect timing, but you know, beggars can't be choosers. So we've sort of had that experience of like prime time TV over there. I mean, you know what our band sounds like better than most. We're never going to break America. But we have this... We do
attitude.
Have a huge number of American...
I got to say, Jeremy, I'm listening to your words and I'm weeping because like, the way you're talking about America is the way we were talking about Norwich.
I'm joking apart.
There isn't a direct motorway there. I'm not going back.
Joking apart, that is...
And once you say no to Norwich, they all crumble.
We know that we are privileged to be able to do it in the first place, to have the funds, albeit at the cost of our own pockets or whatever, to do it in the first place. To be able to do it on a bus, because we did it on a bus, so we're no splitters, no flying, so we actually got some sleep.
Yeah.
It wasn't as punishing as it could be. We had a good time.
The sleeper
what
bus
more do
is
you
such
want?
A... I mean, like, it no, makes I, sense yeah. in America.
Yeah.
In England... In the UK, it certainly is a false economy. That I think, because we've never had a sleeper bus, but we've already decided that if we ever got to that point where we had a sleeper bus, we just know straight away that
we
wouldn't
the
like
same
it.
Thing.
We've been on enough other bands' buses to realize what the real drudgery is of that day to day. It's like it looks horrible. Don't want it.
Katie Harkin said after about 5 days, it's just sweaty camping. Yeah, pretty much what you're saying about having a good time on tour. I remember one of the first foreign gigs we did in Paris. Remember Ollie from Memphis said, don't worry about the gig. It's obviously going to be crap because you've only had one record in the UK. It's not done amazingly, so it's not going to be great. But you've got to have a good time. If
you've
got
to have a good time,
that 40 minutes on stage isn't going to give you any satisfaction this time around. You have to have a good time getting there, staying over, coming back. Otherwise, it's not
and
worth
actually,
it.
Is that
when he bought us a three-course meal on Field Music's money?
Yeah, he did, And I had a great time.
Field Music's money.
And as a result...
I remember the meal so much more than I remember the gig.
You wanted to put that into practice.
It was an Aberdeenshire steak in Paris. And then it was like a really nice chocolate pudding. Afterwards or something. Oh, delicious.
Wonderful. Yeah. So that is not insignificant, I think. We do what we love and we have a good time and you're with your mates and you're playing music. And
like you said,
sometimes maybe you'd want 50 more people in the room, but it's a pretty minor hang-up, really.
But speaking of America, we can't not talk about South by Southwest. What have your experiences been like there? As a band
with
natural infrastructure to actually fund trips, as you've talked about.
Yeah.
You know, you can go to South by Southwest and go, right, well, you know, you go here, this is where you get your team behind you. Like, because when we went, it was all about getting an American booking agent, wasn't it? It was all about getting
that was the aim.
It was all about getting the industry behind you.
And it always is when you go there.
Yeah, of course. Well, when we went there, it was headlined by Lionel Richie and Snoop Dogg. And I was really like, what's the fucking point of the new music? Like, what's the point of us playing three songs? Like, just for that to kind of overshadow the entire thing. You know, I thought it was a bit odd, but like, what have your own experiences been like?
We've done it twice. We cancelled one in 2013 for reasons we couldn't control. And as a result, we did it in 2010. Really young band, first time in America, first time I'd ever been there in any capacity. And we were really excited just to be abroad at that stage, let alone in America. It's the first time experience of anywhere in America I'd been, and I was in the thick of it in Texas, so I was fascinated. We really enjoyed all the gigs, even the ones at like 11:40 a.m. It was a good time as well, you know, with the other British bands that we were knocking around with. It was cool to play with like The Invisible or whoever, you know. It didn't really do anything for us. It didn't really move the needle. We did a CMJ the same year, so that was possibly as a result of that South By. But also because we were just a new band, and that's what you did in those days. And we had the funding, thanks to the PRS Foundation, we had the funding for it. Then we cancelled one in 2013, which left this kind of what-if hanging over us. So we went back and did it again 3 years later in 2016. And it was a total shit show, but for a variety of reasons, because we were that bit older and more jaded, and we knew what it was costing us in every sense. Yeah. Alex got really ill.
Oh, I remember just, that. I remember hearing
food poisoning
that.
Ill.
Yeah. Were you
so
guys
we had to cancel
it?
Two or three shows because of that. We were hoteling it.
Yeah, you see, he was taken to the
Ronald McDonald emergency room by our tour manager. It's literally what it was called. And like me and Mike and John just went out and had a great time basically for 3 days while he got better.
So like, that when you
this is costing us thousands, isn't it? Let's go to this house party.
It was when you billed as anything as well, wasn't it?
We were billed on a radio thing as anything. It was anything. Yeah.
Jesus.
A guy in, I can't remember what town we were in, but on the most recent American tour turned up with a t-shirt done up like that.
Yeah.
With the same font and everything. Yeah. And we recreated the original photo. Yeah.
Actually, that sort of segues nicely as well into every podcast we do a Dutch Uncle's Lowlight. So is there a particular everything low light? Like, it could be anything.
I think maybe the low light from that particular South By is being on stage and cancelling the gig. Like, literally, like, Mike was virtually counting in the first song and we had to cancel. And that was a technical thing. They just didn't have the number of channels possible. And you're exhausted when you're in America. And it gets a lot easier to say, okay, we'll sack it off and go to a Mexican restaurant. We shouldn't have done it in retrospect. We absolutely shouldn't have done it. But these things happen. And the rough and tumble of the road.
I think the problem with us is we did it in 2012 in between releasing albums. And we had like...
at precisely the wrong point.
Yeah.
If we'd have done it the year after, coming off the back of our Out of Touch in the Wild tour, where we'd actually learnt the songs. We had Flexin and Fester at that point. Our most... Yeah. You know, like most intensely successful period we'd ever known at that point. If we had gone in with that feeling on the front foot, as they say in the World Cup, like it would have been such a different time. But instead, for us, it was playing some sets with. I mean, I was just convinced I was going to die out there at some point. So I was having a horrible time thinking death is around the corner.
Played in Nomito for the first time, didn't you?
We hadn't got our head around the new songs yet, so our songs sounded absolutely wild. Mm. And at the same time, my only memories, apart from us having some forgettable gigs, is heckling Slow Club when they're on stage at their set going, "We're from Sheffield," and for some reason you decide to boo them, Andy. They're like, "Who's booing Sheffield in Texas?"
And then Sheffield.
And then the other time, of course, was meeting Daniel Bedingfield.
Of course, yeah.
He's a nutbar.
After we'd done our... after we'd done like the official showcase for the British Embassy or something like
the
that,
third one,
and it was this really tiny venue. We'll get around to tiny venues in a bit.
We've played that,
gig. You know the
couple
one
of
I mean.
Times
like,
in our first year, yeah. British Music
30,
Embassy,
isn't it?
Called,
yeah, it's called Something 30. That and the stairs to the stage are pretty much by the fire exit, so there's no backstage really. You're already outside the building when you've come off. I just remember we came off into this little alleyway, just like, oh, I thought that was a good gig. Turned around and there's just the henchest Daniel Bedingfield you've ever seen. Like, he looked.
Has he done what Craig David's done?
He looked like Bane. Like, he looked like Bane with, like, a girl around each arm.
Hey guys.
Yeah, no, it's like, hey, oh, I really like the... Oh, no.
Michael Jackson.
No. You know
he
what?
He could be Michael Jackson.
No. I'll be Bane.
what an interesting set you've just played.
It's like, oh my fucking God, it's Daniel Bedingfield. It's like, yeah, all right, mate. How's it going? Like, what are you doing here? It's just like,
I've been doing the hotel circuit. Jazz standards on the piano. It's good. But no one talks to the real you.
It's like, oh, okay.
He asked about the name of
it was like, what do you call?
Oh, my God.
What do you call yourself? And then we said, we're Dutch Uncles.
I know what Dutch Uncle.
It's like, that's when you stick your penis up another man's ass and he farts on it.
Is it?
Yeah, no, it's
well,
not.
No. According to Daniel Bedingfield, that's what it is.
There's no other definition of that.
Album. My favourite bit about those.
We just had to agree with it in case he battered us, but it was just like, I'm not sure about that.
Well, then Dan, our manager, comes storming in and gives him a CD.
Yeah,
like,
he still gave him a CD.
We're not going to support Daniel Bedingfield. Like, what is the benefit of this? Like,
oh, bless him.
It's like, sounds very painful.
Stop. So we've just finished two portions of fries.
Potted.
Fries that came in some sort of enamel.
And they were fries, weren't they? They weren't chips.
Yeah, exactly. From Benito Lounge, the new haunt in the centre of Chorlton. So Jeremy, as the guest on the show, do you want to start us off? What did you think when you walked into Benito Lounge? What was your initial impact?
My initial reaction was it was lovely to see you all, of course. And then I looked around and thought, this is a really weird, constructed kind of boho atmosphere where they've got a load of kind of... job lot of sort of charity shop antique paintings of no one in particular. And they're all really tightly packed together on the walls, and they've got the kind of token wacky wallpaper and mismatched furniture, but it's nevertheless undisguisably corporate kind of atmosphere. And therefore, we all really wanted to hate the chips, didn't we?
That's true. That is very true.
We haven't conferred, indeed. But I would say that we had the knives out.
And for the residents of Chorlton, it would almost feel like our decision to go there was based on the fact that we wanted to slag it off.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there was that point as well when Kate Bush came on, and we were like, well...
Yeah, Kate Bush came on.
It wasn't the best of Bush, was it? Like,
well, man with the child in his eyes.
Well, they were playing Portishead whilst we were walking out as well. Which was
great. But these are quite sanitised parts of sort of leftist culture, I suppose, aren't they?
Yeah. I suppose when I walked in there, I felt... I felt like, as we discussed, I felt like we were in Didsbury. I felt this kind of open space reminding me of somewhere.
East Didsbury.
In East Didsbury.
Yeah, we need to qualify that these
days. Yeah, I was going to say, on Wilmslow Road. Stop, is that?
That's the one beyond.
That'd be the one on School Lane.
Is that East Didsbury Village?
Didsbury Village. Yeah.
I felt like it'd be good if I had my son in there, you know, my 3.5-year-old son. There's lots of space, it's all open plan, it's great. Don't think the service was up to much. You know, when we ordered at the bar, it took an age for the chips to come, and they all seemed a bit flustered, but that's, you know, by the by.
There's only three tables in there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in terms of people on them, it was a sea of tables.
Yeah, 40-odd tables in there.
It was outrageous, wasn't it?
However, our prejudice...
outrageous number of tables.
However, our prejudice was probably wrong chip-wise.
Yeah,
we were almost disappointed to enjoy them, and we did enjoy them, I would say.
Yeah, they were good. And it's actually the service, the chip-related service when they got here, because, you know, the chips were nice, you know, double fried probably. Little skin left on the end, the end of the chip, which I liked.
So hot right now.
The mark of authenticity when they've got a little kind of speckled brown bit on the end.
Oh, yeah. And then the double fried stuff. That,
ready salted.
And then the staff came over and asked us if we wanted condiments. Well, A, if we wanted condiments, and B, if we wanted a little plate each to put condiments on, which is pretty good.
Which is really
good.
Style.
To go back to, I suppose what we like in Chorlton is the degree of independence. Is this an independent place? Has it been swallowed up by a huge? I don't know. I suppose it felt like I was walking into somewhere.
It felt like a chain. It felt like it could have
been anywhere.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're trying to bullshit the bullshitters. I think on this front, as we've said about the atmosphere and about the general decor of the place, all they would have to do is 5 minutes of research around Cholton to realise there is a place that is absolutely nailing what they're trying to do, and it's called Man Bites Frog.
Yeah.
Now there is a place that knows how to. Mantle up some very abstract paintings all in a really nice montage. Load of crazy crap on the walls. Uncle Mo's family feedback, definitely.
Yeah.
But Man Bites Frog are doing it completely right on that front. Yeah. Whereas this place looks like a Weatherspoon for people that can't hack reality.
Oh, Jesus. I would count myself into that.
Felt like that. But I understand what you're saying, like, you know, in terms of you would go there if you didn't have a clue. You know what I mean? Like, if you're just like, shit, we need to go somewhere. All right, yeah, that place will do it.
That's big, it's got space, let's go. Yeah.
My problem with it being a chain is that people can go into it expecting something already. And it felt like from when it opened, people just went there immediately. And for example, San Juan on Beach Road, the now number one rated restaurant in Manchester.
Is it?
The best tapas outside Valencia, apparently. Still took months for it to be busy.
Yeah.
So if you have a chain, you have a natural advantage immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
My final point, chips. Good chips.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Decent However, chips.
The place says, fuck off in the next 90 minutes.
Really?
You say that all the time.
It's actually printed on the menu.
That's your catchphrase.
So specific.
During the counting of the first song. Like, hey, welcome to my birthday. Fuck off in the next 90 minutes.
That's why we never play for
more than gigs.
We never play for more than an hour, do we?
Whoa. Why do you think we only play for 75? Tops.
Yeah.
Well, exactly, no, but that was the air I got of that place. It's like, yeah, okay, it's agreeable, but fuck off in the next 90 minutes.
So when my scoring hat on, which is what we'll probably come to in a minute, they're the best pub chips stroke fries that we've had whilst recording this podcast. And I don't even think it's close. I think they're way ahead of the Bowling Green and Bar for 80.
And just to announce right now, we are going to set up a league table.
Yep.
We're going to put it up there so people can see it for everyone to see, like, what the kind of things we'll be grading them on. And we'll probably visit everywhere twice if we can. Although there's a fuckload of places to go. I mean, like, since we said to ourselves we should do that Benito Lounge, we've also realised there's already the Creameries and El Cantor to visit
just
as well.
Up.
They've just popped up already. So, like, at this rate, I mean, we've got to do like another two reviews next week, really, to stay on top of the game.
Yeah. So, how are we weighting the review this way around? Are we going just pure chip or overall experience?
Everything. I think general aura vibe.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, should we do two marks? Can you do like a double?
I don't think.
What does the Observer food reviews it? They do like ambience,
and then they average it out.
Food itself, or something like that.
I think we're trying to avoid the fact that the chips are quite good. So we'll go.
We'll go
just chips.
And that Louisiana hot sauce,
pitchfork style.
I think we've
decimals.
Explained enough about the venue.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, let's do it then. Neil, out of 10, decimals included.
7.1.
Got it. Robin.
7.6.
Oh. 7.6.
You're still dippy from the stag do, mate.
I was going similar. I'll go 7.5. Duncan?
I can't not take into account everything else.
That's fine.
And I really didn't understand some of the offers they were advertising in the bathroom. 6.8.
Offers in the bathroom.
Well, yeah, that sounds a bit. It sounds a bit euphemistic. I know. No, it was actually just posters for like kind of. On a certain day, you can get a meal with either a glass of wine or a chocolate pudding. I was like, "Where's beer?" I mean, I like wine. Don't get me wrong, but I was just like, "Why would it either be a wine or a pudding?" Like, scratching my head at that. I didn't like it. 6.8.
Can't account for taste. It's done. Jez?
I can't give it less than 7 because the chips were good. We didn't have a shit time, and although. I'm just gonna make it a clean 7 because I have to deduct 3 for everything we've just mentioned.
Okay, divided by 5, 7.2.
Jeez, it's a clear.
It's
winner.
Of the league.
And
is
that
it?
Is,
I think so.
Yeah, I think it is.
The thing with this.
Well, no, we did because Atlantic was Atlantic just straight up 7.
That was that was yeah.
It's better than Atlantic.
There you go. Chippe away.
Keep on that.
Yeah.
So you've recently played your biggest headline shows in the UK.
Yeah.
So I suppose you want to reminisce a little bit on your first London show, and I know that Dutch Uncles, you want to talk about your first London show.
Not well, that's a strong word, really. Isn't
yeah,
it?
No, I don't really want to. No.
So what was it like, Ali Pali?
Ali Pali was genuinely great, and one of the kind of moments in our career, I think, and I also remember to enjoy it as it was happening, which is rare, I think, with the high-pressure stuff. But we were reasonably well-drilled at that point, even though that tour had opened with like 3 or 4 gigs that we'd had to cancel because of the extreme weather.
You've still got them coming up, haven't you?
One of them we have. With the other two reschedules, we have played now in Birmingham and Norwich, but we've still got the Dublin show to do in October. Tickets still available.
Tickets still on offer.
October the 7th. So we were slightly kind of rattled by the fact that we were out of step. So we were only 5 gigs as good as we could have been rather than 8 or 9 or whatever it was meant to be at that point. But it didn't matter, and we were in good shape, and it was great to play a kind of fully retrospective set in front of such an engaged audience, and all our families were there. It's literally one of the, I think maybe the second or maybe the first time that we've got all the mums and dads in one room. So that was nice as well. So it did feel like the culmination of something. Not in a sort of fatalistic way, but it definitely felt like our entire career has just sort of led up to that point. Because that's a 10,000 capacity room.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
It's like I was asking you before, like, is it like completing, I don't know, something that you thought would just never be completed, like completing something like SimCity as a computer game. I know it's a weird example to use, but that is just like something that you should never complete in a way. It's just something that just is ongoing. Does it feel like that? Does it feel like you've kind of gone, we're at the precipice of it all now? We're at the peak.
Pinnacle.
Sorry, the pinnacle. Yeah. Thank you, that's the word.
I suppose the thing is, if you're going to do another record, then the challenge is to at least maintain that.
At least maintain that or advance it or whatever. Yeah. I mean, of course, you can't second guess that because, I mean, I don't know what the first London show that will be booked or announced would be on the fifth album, but we're not going to come in with Wembley Stadium or the O2 or something. Yeah. We'll probably take it down a notch and then try and work up from there because we might do more than one.
You have to take into account, I think, for the fans at that stage, like we were talking about South by Southwest being a picture moment for bands. I think when they see their favourite band play a venue like Alexandra Palace, that becomes a picture moment for them.
Yeah.
And I think it's not something that you can really replicate again for the fans. I think a lot of people would find that one moment precious enough in some respects. What I'm saying is that, like, you know, we've all been there, like, when as soon as you're playing venues that are over like 500 capacity, you've got to start finding somewhere different to play in every city you go to after that, because you've got to give your fans an experience. You can't just keep going back to the same venue.
And that gets harder because the number of places you can do in Birmingham or Bristol or wherever start to decline.
Well, especially
there are
around
just
those
fewer
figures.
Numbers around those figures as you get higher. And then when you get into the really upper echelons, there are actually 2 or 3 options in, say, Birmingham. There are like 3 arenas there now. And we're not at that level. Yeah.
So how many gigs do you think it's been since playing Alexandra Palace to your very first London gig? How many gigs do you think that was as a chain?
I'd say around 600.
I thought you were just going to say around 6. I was like, fuck.
not in London. Not
you played 3 specific,
in general. In general. Like everywhere around the world. But no, I mean, since the first London show... So our first London show was at Cargo in 2008.
How was that?
Any particular strong memories of that?
We were still sans, in a way, because it was so pressured. Because we'd had offers to play London, and then people that we'd kind of made contact with in the industry, we'd say, oh, we're going to play this nightmare warehouse on Curtin Road, and you've got to be there, man. And then the gig would get cancelled by the police. And that happened literally about 5 times. And then finally we got... It was a blessing in disguise, that, because we weren't really ready. The gigs probably weren't right for us. And indeed, they were illegal. But
it's all outrage.
So by the time we got to Cargo and we were
opening on a four-band bill at about 6:45 p.m. And I remember the Twilight Sad, that Scottish band, were the headliner. And there was another band that were doing pretty well from the same part of the world, Edinburgh or Glasgow, on that bill. I can't remember what they were called. And then someone else, and then us. And we were on almost before the doors open. And I remember being in Mike's Ford Focus, driving down to the gig, because we used to just take the combos, the drum breakables, and then the guitars would be wedged between our knees.
Oh, yeah, we've all done two carloads. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And writing the guest list, because we had kind of industry fuss behind us at that point. And I would be on the phone every other minute writing the guest list on the back of a red gas bill for me and John's shared flat on Palatine Road, which is like, pay now! Yeah. And then I'd be writing, Steve Lamack, plus one, on the back of it. and being just like unbelievably stressed orchestrating all of this. We had a guy that was trying to manage us at the time who'd kind of levered us onto the bill, and he'd got us the gig, really, and he also managed to organise us a bass amp, which obviously I was particularly grateful for on the night,
so that I could play the gig.
It's an interesting point you made, actually, about being a northern band. You feel like you have to play London.
Yeah.
Hook a bike, you've got to go down to London. You've got to get all your shit into the full focus.
Yeah.
Do that look, which can, if traffic is generous, is 5 hours.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Sometimes.
And the amount of times we've done that drive back.
Straight after, as well.
We counted all the gigs, didn't we, a few years back. Must be.
Sounds like one of our kind of Saturday nights, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
And that element of stress to it as well.
Mike was doing all the driving because none of us were qualified.
Of course,
yeah.
So he had that extra burden and he'd be completely sober as well, which the rest of us were like, 3-pint minimum before we go on, yeah?
Oh, Mikey's a soldier though.
So what was Dutch Uncle's first London show?
The only London gig I can really remember of those days was when we did a two-car jobby down to a venue in Shoreditch. I can't remember which. We might have already spoken about this on this podcast, when we supported Liam's and the Party Squad. What were they called? The Last Party from Manchester.
They were the Pedestrians at the time.
The Pedestrians.
Well, no, I'm pretty sure they were the Last Party at that point, weren't they? I don't know. Well, we supported them. And we drove down in two cars for the occasion.
This was before Dutch Uncles.
This Headlines era?
Yeah, this is Headlines era. And this is the only gig of that around that time, because it was like the last Headlines gig in London, I think.
Yeah.
And we got down there and we did our gig, and I hadn't even written lyrics to one song yet, so I was actually freestyling. I was like, I might as well have been rapping over that song that we call Pencil Case. Nobody liked it.
We did that at the O2.
Everyone in the crowd.
Sorry, I've interrupted.
Just to be as brief as possible, nobody liked the gig. We left. Made that situation worse that we realised the only reason we'd been booked for that gig was because our ex-manager wanted to fuck the promoter. And we'd driven 187 miles there, 187 miles back. We'd done that whole thing just so you could bed a promoter.
That's music industry.
And it didn't occur to us until Tollington Services northbound. It was absolutely shocking.
We just went, it's not minute. Even a good servo.
It was like, wait a minute, did anyone say goodbye to him? No, he'd gone. Of course he'd gone. He'd already got his coat to speak as diplomatically as possible.
Yeah.
But so you riffed at O2.
Oh, yeah.
O2.
Yeah, we did an entire UK tour supporting Snow Patrol around arenas.
Wasn't going to mention it, but now
at the beginning of 2012, which was our first experience of doing arenas. And they really looked after us. They paid us really well. And we just behaved appallingly throughout. Because we were having sort of standing rows and catering with the crew, and we were just drunk off our ass by like 8:15, and basically we were allowed to go on and do what we liked for 40 minutes at 7:30 every night, and we used it as a way to rehearse. Well, maybe that's the wrong word, but to road test songs that were to become our second album predominantly. And we did play stuff in the first record, but people didn't know who we were anyway, so it didn't matter. So we just stuck in loads of new material. The song that was to become Radiant, we would close the set with. At the time, it had the working title of Philly, because John was trying to emulate Philadelphia by Bruce Springsteen. And it just didn't have any words. So he would just sing really graphic nonsense over it. And there's a live recording of us four consecutive nights at the O2 with John singing this really horrendous stuff, like drenched in reverb.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and then eventually he did write some words for it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's a good song.
I'm fond of that song.
Just to bring it all back to a more of a, not a sobering point, but a more business type of point, we're talking about toilet venues, as we call them. And of course, you're part of a
Music Venue Trust.
You're part of the Music Venue Trust. We more affectionately call it, and don't take this the wrong way, we mean this in the most affectionate way, the patron saint of dogshit venues. Do you mind that?
Well, bless you. Joking apart, the fact that you refer to my position as the patron saint of dogshit venues, that is part of the cultural problem, in a way.
We're the problem, Jeremy.
No, you're not the problem. But in a way, our complacent attitude is part of the problem. In a way, the broader complacent attitude is part of the problem, because we have grown up with these institutions and we take them for granted, and we dismiss them as toilet venues or what have you. We can't take it for granted, because actually there's no state funding for this stuff like there is in Europe. Europe has the same infrastructure. It's really well spec'd. They look after you better. They feed you better. The rides
are
better. Traveling,
like when you tour these venues.
You go to a 400 capacity venue in Ghent.
We found that out in Germany, didn't we? When we went to Germany, we were like, oh, you're giving us beer?
Yeah,
you can, and when we run out, you'll give us more.
Yeah, I mean, and that there is state funding for that over there. It's not that we can't expect it. We should expect it, but it is not forthcoming here. So there needs to be some other infrastructure. There needs to be some other mechanism in place to preserve the grassroots, because otherwise there's going to be this trickle-up effect whereby suddenly Adele and the Arctic Monkeys are just not going to be there anymore. Not those artists in particular, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah, of course.
Figuratively
speaking,
we're not going to have festival headliners in 15 years' time if we take away the springboard at the outset. Yeah. Okay.
Do you think gentrification has anything to do with it? Like, in the sense of like Night and Day, where Night and Day is a cultural institution, independent venue, and people used to flock there or whatever. It's still a great venue, and then it's part of this scene that everyone wants to live around. So the guy above it, the guy above Night and Day or opposite it, buys a £300,000 one bed flat, and then complains about the noise.
Yeah,
so that's got to be an issue. Effectively,
it's a huge issue. So in answer to your question, yes. Definitely, that is a factor.
There's nothing they can do about that, though, is there really?
No, it shouldn't be the case that your license is suspended after one complaint.
Yeah.
And that is the current
problem. I suppose that's law, isn't it, though?
For the time being, it is. But that's something that we're working on kind of overturning. The reason that these places become attractive places to move, they are bohemian destinations, is because of the work that's put in by the music venues at the... who almost to a man, if you look at these areas that have sprung up around music venues, the Northern Quarter wasn't the Northern Quarter before Night and Day.
It wasn't.
No. It was sort of Ancoats war zone.
Yeah.
And people didn't want to go there. And Night and Day was the first outpost.
But it's like the sort of hub, isn't it? It's where it all starts and it sort of spreads from there.
And then people go, oh, I'd love to live there. It looks really happening. Yeah. And then they complain about the noise from the very thing that made it happening in the first place.
Yeah.
It's an attitudinal problem as much as it is a legislative problem.
Yeah. So even go back further. I'm old enough, as you'll tell me. I actually played the Boardwalk when I was, you know, starting off, and that...
Wow.
What year was that?
Oh, God.
1996.
Wow.
Just before my 8th birthday.
Just before your 8th.
So
that was the occasion.
Jesus Christ. But I suppose that was the first... That's probably the first music venue that I suppose I know of, and I've played out there, was that Victim I got turned in the flats. Mm-hmm. Other ones I'm thinking of is the Beer Keller.
Yeah,
that's a big loss, man. The beer
yeah,
Keller.
I'm going to lose the Beer Keller.
It's a big loss. So there's the Roadhouse. Staples.
These are city centre venues.
Less so, you can never see the legs of the people playing it. I did find that a bit weird. It was a bit odd.
We'll come
it was
back
a bit
to
like
the artist's
Muppets,
attitude.
Like,
yes. Yeah, don't worry about it.
Thank you, Duncan. regionally speaking,
The problem is that the buildings are worth more than the business as a live music venue.
Yes, they are, yeah.
So my friends who set the charity up, and it is a charity, Music Venues Trust, have known me since I was like 13, because I would go to them and go, can I have a gig, when I lived in Tunbridge Wells. I grew up in Tunbridge Wells in Kent before I moved to Manchester. And their building, which is an ex-public toilet on common land, big sort of circle of a building, is worth more as a piece of land that they can sell to Pizza Express or to a hotel chain than it is worth as a music venue. Somebody came to them with a huge offer and they were very tempted to take it, and they held their nerve and said, culturally, this is more valuable to the community than it is worth to us financially. And that's an amazing thing to have done.
Then they
set up the venue, the Music Venues Trust, as a way to protect the status of British music venues.
But that's the gap where the state should intervene, really, where it has more
value
to the community.
But that just isn't going to happen under the current government, regards the arts as this source of frippery on the side. I do think artists should deserve and should expect better
service.
You know, being able to have a hot shower if you've been travelling all night from Newcastle or whatever.
I mean, we're dealing with a relatively right-wing government now.
Yeah.
Where does that actually come from in the past?
I don't really know.
Because we've never had state-funded for venues.
No, we haven't. And the closest thing we got, I suppose, was that, like, the New Deal for musicians in the 90s under New Labour or whatever, which was a kind of, exercise.
Is it because we've been fortunate to have great British big band exports? And as soon as we had that, it's like, this industry's fine. We don't
That. And the idea that the arts should stand on its own two feet,
which is
that it doesn't have any.
Really, it's the one industry in the world that can't stand on its
own. Yeah, yeah, but it doesn't have any broader cultural or educational or even mental health value that should be invested in by government, which is the problem. It's just patently untrue.
Yeah.
Case in point with Manchester. How do you feel about the Star and Garter situation? Because they've been because they've been threatening to make like a Platform 15 at Piccadilly for years now.
We need those places. We need them. There's once they're gone, they're gone. Because there are new venues opening, but under different terms, corporate terms, and in very low numbers, and only really in London.
Yeah.
Once we lose them, and once the regions, as people will insist on referring to the entire country, lose them, that's it, man. And we can't expect to be the leader in popular music globally if we're pulling the rug from under the feet of younger artists.
Should we do favourite small venues?
Yeah, yeah? This is a good positive note to end on.
Yeah, yeah, favourite small venues.
Bristol Thekla, despite everything we've just said. I mean,
good choice.
Is that a small venue?
Yeah, technically.
If you play there, as we all know,
Under 500.
Definitely under 500. But it feels bigger because you've got those galleries, or one gallery, and if you play there, it's a ball ache, because Bristol is further than you think. You've got to hump the gear down a really steep staircase. It's on a fucking boat, which moves in the water.
There are no lights
in the dressing room, so you're literally in the bilges in the dark.
The dressing room's
If you're a local and you go to see a band there, what a special experience that is.
Yeah, fair.
So I can't knock it.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember when we played at the Thekla with the Futureheads, and two of the Automatic turned up, and they were big fans of ours. It's like, oh,
was mate, Penny there?
It wasn't Penny.
Ah, fuck it. That
was the fucking point.
Neil, go on.
I suppose outside Manchester, it probably is the Brudenell. I'm gonna get the Brudenell in really early before.
You're wearing a Brudenell T-shirt.
I am. Yeah.
For the people at home, I'd just like to clarify that.
Yeah, yeah. I just think it's ridiculous that a venue of that quality exists kind of where it does in Leeds. You know what I mean? And sort of it's just a bit out of the city centre. There's such an amazing degree of independence there. Rob, it's you next. Best venue, small venue.
Trades Club, before, but like when we played there last year, that was one of my favourite gigs last year.
Yeah, it was really good.
It was just we were treated so well. We had that like that house, like the shop front next door. Best ride we'd had that whole year for one of the smallest gigs, and it was just a really good vibe.
And they've got that lovely patio. We can sit by the river.
Exactly. Yeah.
They never chuck you out.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Andy?
I'm going to go with Lexington in London.
Yes.
I thought it was very unexpected to have a venue that nice above a pub in London.
I really wish there wasn't that evidence of us playing there. There on the internet somewhere. It's really bad.
Yeah, I love that small, sort of almost prestigious venue in London.
I think we should give yours. Actually, I might be undercutting you, so you go first.
Go for it.
I thought we should just give an honourable mention to Night and Day.
Yeah, no, we should.
Yeah, because we all started our careers there.
First Uncle's gig.
Yeah, the first everything gig.
Yeah, and when we were talking about doing a 10th anniversary show, I was in my head, I was thinking, like, we really should do it there if we were going to do it anywhere. Yeah.
But what's yours, Dunk?
Well, I mean, a few come to mind, really. I feel like if we played it more, it would definitely be the Casimir. We only played there once.
Yeah.
And I remember when we got there,
I
was like, so fucking dusty. What's going on? But then as soon as the gig started, I was really fascinated by the windmill feature they had up on the ceiling, you know, like a massive air fan. And when you see the light show that the Crombie brothers, who ran that place, because now they run Invisible Wind Factory, when you see what that does in effect, it was such a vibe in there. And I remember when the gig came around, because it was a Friday night, because every time we ended up playing Liverpool, it was always like, well, it's a Friday night, here we go, you never know what's going to happen. Liverpool is always a party, it's so good.
Yeah.
So Casimir would be one. The Joiners in Southampton would be another one.
Yeah, where you load in through the sash windows at the back of the venue. I love
because that place is just so dilapidated when you get there. But everyone who goes there is such a good
guy. That's under constant threat, that place. But thirdly, and we've already mentioned the Casimir that's already gone.
Yeah,
because of property development.
Francis Long ate my Greggs.
Did it? I know that he's got some sway at the creameries, so maybe we'll get some free chips to review at the creameries now that he's eating your Greggs.
Thomas Jules Forum, Glasgow King Tuts, Newcastle Clooney, there we go.
Yeah, and every other small venue under the sun, you're all doing a great job.
So that's it for episode 4 of Chips of Chortland. Hope you've enjoyed. Subscribe, please. Bit of news at the end of the podcast. We are going to perform. Is perform the right word?
It certainly isn't.
It is a perform. We're opening up the second stage at Blue Dot on the Friday. So if you're going to Blue Dot, you think you're getting there about 1 or 2. No, get there about 10:30, 11, and we'll be opening up the second stage at Blue Dot.
With another special guest.
Another special guest. We won't announce it just yet. We'll just keep you...
It's a biggie.
It's a big one. Yeah. But yeah, thanks to Rob, Andy and Dunk, and a thanks to our very,
guest.
Very special guest, Jeremy.
Saint for Jeremy.
We upgraded.
Saint Jeremy.
Thank you very much for having me, boys. I loved it. Thank you.
Thank you.